in separated families, lots of kids did not have a good relationship with their dad who had left. Until the age of about 15 or 16, those girls who had a dad who said, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean it to end this way, you know, we both made mistakes." They said to me that dad had shown a chink in his armour, that he'd said sorry, that he'd shown a fragility they hadn't seen before, and that allowed them to say to him, "I've stuffed up."
Exactly, yeah, and vulnerability incites vulnerability.
In 1837, Horace Mann created the education system, a system at the time designed to pump out factory workers and professors. The same system that is still being used today in the 21st century. Now, Mann's system is backfiring. We are being moulded by the same industrial system that has existed for close to 200 years. That system delivers us into a digital economy that has no need of our outdated skills. This isn't our teachers' fault. This isn't the government's fault. This is due to a rapidly changing world full of technology and unforeseen circumstances. And us Gen Zs are caught in the middle. Welcome to the Driven Young Podcast, the podcast for stressed, overwhelmed young Australians, teaching you practical life skills you can implement now to set yourself up in life. And now your host, Byron Dempsey.
Welcome back to the Driven Young Podcast, and today I'm joined by a wonderful woman, Madonna King. Madonna King is one of Australia's most accomplished journalists, having won awards for her ABC Radio Brisbane Morning Current Affairs program. She writes across Nine, Crikey, and The New Daily, and is the author of numerous books, including the best-selling Being 14, Fathers and Daughters, and Teenager. She's also the biographer of Australia of the Year Professor Ian Fraser and former Treasurer Joe Hockey. In 2018, Madonna served as Chair of Queensland Government Anti-Cyberbullying Task Force, set up in the wake of COAG. Whew. So, as you can see, she is a very accomplished woman and she has achieved a lot. And in today's episode, we dive deep into topics of conversation all about young people. Having done countless studies, she interviews with young people. Madonna has revealed what she is seeing and how we can help fix some of the issues in the world with young people. As per usual, please DM me on Instagram if you enjoy the show. Your messages mean the world to me and I'll answer every single one of you. It really helps the show continue. All the links you need for everything are in the show notes below. But now, over to Madonna. All right. Madonna, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very excited about this episode. I know you do work a lot with young people and you're kind of doing a lot of stuff around young people. You've just released a book, I believe. And I guess before we get into, I guess, the lessons you've learned, your story, you work in journalism, you've been Sydney, Brisbane, all the cool stuff you've done. I'd just love to know, what did you do after high school? And what was the decision-making process like for you during that?
Yeah, so I grew up in country Queensland to very strict parents, but perhaps really quite old-fashioned parents, I think, now. Yep. So they had this view that you educate a girl and you educate a family, you educate a boy and you educate one person, which I just think is bizarre. And as gorgeous as they were, they didn't let me go beyond year 10. And so I was unemployed halfway through year 11, or at the beginning of year 11. And so they let me go on to year 11. And then at the end of year 11, a teacher stepped in and said, "You could go to university." Hadn't even been on my radar. Mm. And I said, "No, I don't think so." And he saw my parents, sat them down and said she could. So I actually probably went to university against their best wishes. And to me, it was an absolute dream. It opened the world to me. And it's just so different from then when I see my daughters, where it's just the thing everyone does.
For you, it was just like incredible privilege, where for them, it's just like the expectation.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And, you know, you say that word expectation. That's a horrible word, isn't it? And someone told me, I wrote a book called Being 14 a few years ago, and I interviewed 250 14-year-old girls, and they said that often mum would say things to them like, I only went back to work to put you through private school. And so there's this expectation they'll achieve. Mm. And they said with dad, he can get angry with their marks and it's over. A lot of them said with mum, their quote was, "It gets under my skin." And so they don't know how to respond. And there's this thing someone said to me that with each generation, there's expectation inflation. So we want our offspring to be 25% better off than we are. How do you do that? Send them to university.
Yeah. How do you measure,
then postgraduate degree.
How do you measure better?
Yeah.
How do you what is 25% better? Is it happiness? Yeah. Is it like, what is it?
Yeah. Is it wealth? Is it a bigger house? Is it, what is it? And it's very different from my generation to the generation of my children.
Yeah. Amazing. And so you went to university. What did you study?
journalism.
Yeah.
And I had no idea. In this country town, they brought a bus down in year 12, and we went around University of Queensland, and I went around and I went to the social work pavilion, and they were just scared me. And I got back on the bus and thought, I have no idea what I want to do with my life. And I looked outside and people were running around with microphones. I went down and said, what's this? This guy, who later ended up being my lecturer, said in this really gruff voice, go and interview 20 people and get back here. And I just thought, what? You could be paid to do this? And that was the beginning of, I only ever wanted to do journalism after that.
Yeah, amazing. Cool. And so that started your journalism career. So, I mean, it's always super interesting, the fact that you say that it's very different to now with your daughters.
Yeah.
Because how old are your daughters?
18 and 19.
Right. So it's that perfect age where they're making that decision right now, or they have just recently made the decision.
Yeah.
So I guess, what are you... Maybe give us a synopsis of what you've kind of done with your life since then and what you're currently up to with young people and the studies you're doing in that space.
So I became a journalist and I went and worked in America for a year. I spent a lot of time in the Canberra Press Gallery. Politics is in my blood in terms of reporting. I'm a political reporter, but it's quite devastating when you see, I remember as a young reporter seeing the Attorney General in one state asleep as legislation was passed that mandated life in jail for drug traffickers. Now, drug traffickers probably should spend the rest of their life in jail, but this is the person responsible for that legislation, and he was asleep as it was passed. And I think in politics I saw the best and the worst of people. I guess. So politics a lot. I've worked across radio, television and newspapers online. I hosted the Morning Current Affairs program on ABC in Queensland for many years. And then I decided to write books, and I've written, I think, 12 from biographies. Professor Ian Fraser, who developed the cervical cancer vaccine. And my last four have been on teenagers, so being 14, fathers and daughters, teenagers, and just now L platers on that 16, 17, 18 year olds.
Yeah, which is kind of like my target demographic. Is, I mean, I kind of say 16 to 25 is who I talk to, but I love specializing in that period in life where I say it's like a, you know, a shitstorm. It's like everything's hitting you at once. You're starting the date, you've got to choose your career, you're moving out of home, like all this stuff is hitting you at once, and you're like, oh my God, it's very overwhelming.
And I think school is not preparing kids for that.
No.
You know, in this one, L Platers, I interviewed 1,000, and they are graduating without financial literacy, without a license, without being enrolled to vote, without having done a first aid course, without actually listening to that little voice inside of them. And it's so funny because I didn't know of you, and one of my daughters said, you can't write a book like that unless you've, you know, listened to Driven Young. And it was so funny because I listened to it and I kind of can't help thinking that you are living the bucket list life of so many young people who want to do what you say but are scared to do it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think you've listened to episodes. At the end of every episode, I ask a guest, what's the number one piece of advice to an 18-year-old?
Yeah.
I've written the book, 18 and Lost, which was, you know, one of my chapters. And a common theme that I see across all the answers people give me is take risks.
Yeah.
It's like, take risks, because now I can't. You're in a position where you can take so many risks. I'm 45. I've got children to look after. I've got three mortgages. I've got like all this stuff. I can't afford to take a risk. You can afford to drop everything and go work in Europe or go do whatever you want. And people just make excuses, they complain, oh, but what about money? Get a job.
Well, and you know, one other thing there I found in this latest book is COVID we're not talking about. You know, and I know it was a pain in the ass, and I know we did better than other countries, but there is no doubt that, well, university staff are saying they're seeing 15-year-olds at first-year university instead of 18-year-olds. They're acting like 15-year-olds.
Oh, right, right.
And the reason is, think of what we did when we were 16, 17 and 18. Think of the stupid things we did, the misjudgments we made, the risks we took, and that's how we learnt to adult. And I think COVID has stolen that from young people. And I spoke to one demographer in my research, and he said from a health perspective, the elderly were the most vulnerable. But from every other perspective, particularly economic and socially, it was the cohort you are talking to that were the most disadvantaged. They lost part-time jobs. They lost connection. They lost bonds. They lost everything.
Well, it's also like, if I look at someone, like COVID hits, let's say, and you're 50 years old, and COVID hits and you're Well, let's say you're 80 years old.
Yeah.
And you're 17 years old. Obviously, the 80-year-old's at a much higher risk of actually succumbing to the disease.
However, from a health perspective.
From a health perspective. But from an 80 to 83, how different is your life?
Yeah.
But from 17 to 21, how different is your life? Like, those are the formative years that are creating us. Even I look at, like, my parents or something, and it's like they went through a lot. They've got a business and everything, and mum's had to deal with so much stuff. But even then, from where she was to where she is now, her life hasn't changed too drastically because she's settled and she's in that kind of point of her life where she's just not going through the motions, but they've established a lot of roots. We haven't established any roots at 17.
Well, absolutely. And that trajectory, let's take the gap year.
Yeah.
The gap year just shut down.
Yes.
Even kids whose passion was, you know, a language, you would go and study or work as a barista overseas, gone.
I know so many people. I mean, one of my best friends, Annalise, she was going to go to China.
Yep.
She spent 4 years studying Chinese language along with law. That didn't go ahead. Some of my mates were going to go to Switzerland, Sweden. They all had these big things planned. Bang, gone.
Well, our family's always hosted Italian exchange students oh, cool. and just loved it. You know, we're really close to their families, three of them. And so our aim was for our youngest daughter, who loved Italian, to go and do the same thing, and that shut down.
Mm.
And so her passion for Italian has reduced. She loves French now. But the thing is, those opportunities, and it sounds really first world, but it doesn't have to be. You can get a cheap flight over there and work as a barista and learn the language.
Yes, yes.
And I think, you know, I get really angry at our policymakers and our politicians because I kind of think, and even some of our educators are saying, oh, for God's sake, get on with it. This builds resilience. This is, you know, it's not World War One. They had it harder.
Yeah.
Well, it's not World War One. We know that. But I don't know why there's a lesson in making it harder.
Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult for people who are, and I guess the older generations, to understand what it was like going through COVID as a young person. Because you're right. There is a level of just like, oh, we couldn't. Like, I'm 24. I feel like I'm 22. And everyone says you got a minus 3 years off your life. That's a, kind of like the joke. Oh, minus 2-3 years off because of COVID. Because that's genuinely what it's like.
Yeah.
And I got a lot done during COVID.
Yeah.
But even then it was like, you know, I couldn't travel. I had a lot of traveling plans. I had a lot of stuff planned. And it really just, because something I refer to quite a bit is for 18 to 25 year olds, the Australian government did a study and they said their biggest worry for young people 18 to 25 from COVID wasn't the health effects. Number one was the mental health impact.
Yeah.
And number two was the lack of education. And number three was the virus itself.
Absolutely. I don't think it was COVID. I think it was the uncertainty that built the mental health issue.
Yes. Yeah.
And I asked the 1,000 of them, what is your biggest challenge in your life? 700 of them said their mental health, from anorexia, panic attacks, anxiety, self-harm, school refusal. And we're not addressing that. I mean, 700 of 1,000, if that was another issue, there would be a royal commission and we'd be looking at it. And what does the government do? And I'm not pro one side or the other, but the government says, oh, we'll rebate more psychology appointments. But they don't provide more psychologists.
I was going to say, it's a 12-month wait.
Yeah.
12 months.
So how's that going to help any young person? And I, you know, so my heart goes out to that cohort and even a bit younger because they're seeing what happened to their big brothers and their big sisters.
Mm.
And at school we're saying, oh, just get on with it. Get on with it. And even one thing I picked up in Melbourne was girls who were really ambitious and wanted to do an academic course at uni lost that ambition during COVID. The first year was great. They raced through the work. Mm. The second year, because they had 250 days of lockdown, was just, I want to close the books. Mm. I want Christmas to come and no more study.
Mm.
And how do we gift that time back to them is the question, I guess. Or how do they gift it back to themselves?
Well, my biggest worry is that because COVID hit, and let's say they're going to go on a gap year, they're going to do this cool stuff, but rather than that, they've skipped that and they've gone straight to uni, and then you're going to come out of uni, go straight into a job, and bang, that's it. They've missed their opportunity to kind of just travel as a young person, to do cool stuff and just, not that they've missed the opportunity, but they've missed the opportunity to just do it with no responsibilities.
Yeah.
And my worry is they're going to settle down too quickly.
Of course they are. Do you think it happens earlier though? Like at school now, I can't help thinking that it's the academic kids and the others. You know, one girl said to me, they invite all these people back, past students, to say how you can get the top ATAR.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, I could work night and day and never get that. How does that make me feel?
Yeah.
And I wonder if now, you know, and there's been this STEM thing, particularly around young females. And so the kids who just love art and history, and we need great historians, are feeling second rate, that it's all, there's no balance. And balance is a word I never actually probably really respected or put a lot of kudos on until after this.
Well, there's very much a hierarchy at school when it comes to the different things you're studying. And they literally, like, I mean, in New South Wales at least, they rank their hierarchy. As in economics, if you get an 18 in economics, that's going to do a lot more than an 18 visual arts. It's literally ranked.
Every
in, like,
state does it.
Anything that has creative usually weighs less. Yep. Like, again, one of my friends, she was just like, I want to do this, 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 this. I'm like, oh, but aren't you going to do any high-ranking subjects? How are you going to get a high ATAR with those?
Yeah.
And the secret is, if you do well in every subject, you're going to get a high ATAR no matter what it is.
Yes.
But there's a lot of pressure. It's like, oh, you have to pick a science and you have to do math and you have to do English. That's half of them gone.
Yep.
And it's like, why? What if I'm not interested in that?
So, and in year nine, do you really know what you want to do?
No.
You don't. And so you get on this path. And I think also maybe females more than males put a ceiling on their own ability. So in, you know, when they're 10 and 11, they'll see their friends getting 8 out of 10 at maths, they'll get 6 and they'll go, I'm not a math science girl. And they end up going another path. And, yeah, you know, there's a lady, Rebecca Sparrow, who does a lot with young people too in Queensland, and we got together and started this website called Testing Times at School and said, what is your experience in terms of academic? And the stories, there's 1,000 of them at the moment, are just heartbreaking, you know, from attempted suicide to all mental health related. But I'm not sure. We went and saw the authorities and said, so how is the curriculum developed? And do you know there is not one mental health expert involved in any committee that determines what a 17-year-old studies? That's not right, is it?
No. And I had the founder, or I had one of the guys who worked in the Finland education system, and he was like very high up, and he's in Australia now. And he was saying up until 18 years old, they don't have a single exam. So they don't do any exams until they're 18 years old throughout primary school and high school.
Yeah.
And they've got the number one education system in the world.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of strong opinions on markings and, like, ranking and, you know,
assessment.
It's that success thing we were speaking about. You know, we're ranking where you are in terms of success. And so the people who get really high marks have this, they have this illusion that they're really intelligent.
Yeah.
And then they enter the real world and go, oh my God, a lot of this doesn't transfer over. And the people with low marks have this delusion that they're not intelligent.
And the way you talk about success is exactly how this whole generation does, but not necessarily their parents.
Mm.
You know, and when I ask them, you know, they want purpose. They want to be content.
Yeah.
But they're not sure how to do it because it conflicts a little bit with mum and dad, who may be actually paying for the the short-term trajectory. And it's, you know, they don't want to be, well, it's a generalization, but when I said, how do you define success? Very, very few said wealthy. A couple of did, or a big job, but most of them described something that was a passion or something that was a sense of purpose.
Yeah, and they're saying this generation is far more focused on passion and purpose rather than finances.
Of course.
Which is, and it's tough because you still need to have good finances because it's very expensive living in this country.
Yep.
And it's finding that balance of just like, well, you know, then, doing what you want to do, but then also having good the finances, being intelligent with your money. And
well, yeah, and maybe you'll disagree with me, but I think, you know, money can buy purpose in a sense. Like
it
I was
can.
Speaking to a young 100%. Person who said, oh, you know, I'm doing this high finance course and I want to do it to help a charity and I just don't like that you're paid a lot in a merchant bank. And I said, well, earn the money and then do something with it to help someone else. You know, there's different ways of, you know.
I got two friends who are doing that. They're kind of like studying to start getting VC and investing and stuff. And now they're working for like Deloitte and whatnot. And they're like, we just want to do this until we're 25, save a bunch of money, invest a lot of money, and then we'll have money that we can go start our own like fund in our own company, which is like driven and is supposed to be good. Oh, what's it called? It's like a company that does more than just money.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a purpose.
It's got a purpose.
Trying to solve something that's not just making money.
Well, do you know the story of Orange Sky Laundry?
No.
So it's now opened in America. It's right through Australia. And it was these two bright boys who decided we're going to do something about homelessness. So they got this van and got a washing machine in the back of it and a couple of orange chairs. And they go and to homeless under bridges, the back of lanes, and they sit on an orange chair and actually talk to the homeless while washing their clothes. And it was just an idea that these two blokes who were 18 had that has actually changed the trajectory without a cent, really. Well, now they've got sponsorship. Now across America they want to open it. And you think that's actually not about academic or an education. It's about thinking, here's a problem, you know, and this is what I would like to do. I mean, how good is that?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's a guy, I wrote about a guy in my book, Darren something, I forget his last name, but he was a guy who was, he's a black man, and he sat down with like hundreds of members of the KKK.
Yeah.
And he sat down and like bought them a coffee and just asked them, so why do you do it?
Yeah.
And through those conversations, he's managed to have like 50 to 60 to 70 members give up their robes and stop being part of the KKK. And I think it's such an inspiring thing because it's very easy to just be hateful and just be like, these people are horrible, because they kind of are. But he took the other, like you mentioned, and he sat down with them. He said, so why do you do this? And like befriended them. And through doing that, he was able to provide a lot of good.
So in a funny, ironic way, they were looking for a purpose too, weren't they? It was probably just a bad purpose.
Yeah. And I mean,
they opened up to,
they were probably born into it. I would assume they were born into it. Yeah. I don't know much about that, but I just found that kind of mindset very inspiring.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good mindset to have. And just like the orange chair thing, it's like, if you're in school and they said, how do we fix homelessness? No one would ever think of that. Like,
no, it's such and it's so simple.
Yeah, it's so simple.
Yeah.
It's like, that's where creativity and thinking outside the box can be very beneficial.
Yeah, I think one thing that prohibits that with 18 to 25-year-olds is they don't feel as though they're being listened to. I think they are, because they have this massive social media power that is just part of their lives, so they don't recognise. But the fact that you can't vote at 16, to me, is a little bit bizarre when you can make decisions in everything else. But I think as our politicians are old and predominantly white and predominantly male, you know, that they are governing for a different Australia than someone who is 19 and deciding what they want to do with their life.
It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating seeing I'll speak as a young person. It's very frustrating seeing these like old white men who are just making all these decisions. And it's like, they don't understand how the world works. They're not in the room, and they're probably really wealthy. So they're not sure what's going on for the average Australian. It's very frustrating. Like, you've seen what's happened in America.
Yeah.
With the recent laws that have just passed.
Roe v. Wade. Yeah.
The abortion things. If you look at the average age is like 55 to 70 or 80 or something.
But do you think there is a way of flipping that young people organized could actually just change the trajectory, both their own trajectory and how their parents see success, but also more broadly? Like, does it just need to be organised?
I don't know. I mean, look at like Jacinta Ardern. I think she went into office at 35.
Yep.
And now I think she's 40 now. But I mean, she's a great example. She's done a phenomenal job, and she's not 55, 60. Like, it shows that young people can make an impact.
And just politically, I reckon same-sex marriage is also almost a textbook approach, because what they did, they were so strategic, the organisers, and they just got people on side a little bit by a little bit. And I remember my mum died around that time, and she was well into her 80s, and she got it so she could tick it and say yes. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a country woman in her 80s seeing this as a priority. But it was how strategic it was about love not even so much commitment, but that idea of why do we isolate people? Why aren't we actually kind, which is a word we don't use very much. But I wonder if that kind of strategic thinking was put to other things, from climate change to voting at 16 to actually having a greater voice in our school curriculum, which to me has to be the number one, the one area where we change.
I mean, and that's what my whole mission is with this podcast and everything. It's like, how can we change Australia's education system? Because it's like, there's a lot of issues going on in the world. You already mentioned some, climate change, blah, blah, blah. I can't fix all of those issues, but I believe if we can fix the education system, a byproduct of fixing that will be all these other issues. So educate the young people so that they don't know what to focus on.
Yeah, and so that, but also don't their parents have to value something that's not on an ATAR? Like, you don't learn and assess teamwork, being articulate, being a good listener, being able to communicate, which is your whole career, really.
Yes, yes.
And you don't test any of that at school. So I can understand parents getting a report card and then thinking, oh, gee, how good is that? You got an A for physics.
Yeah.
And putting the other to the side until parents, I think, actually say to the school, well, you know, well, what was he like at this? And is he a team player? Is he going to make a leader? None of those things are judged. I'm not sure the pressure then is on politicians to change it. The fact that we don't have a mental health expert sitting down with curriculum in curriculum review saying, hold on, that workload is ridiculous. Or what about, where is balance here? And they're little changes that I reckon can be made. We've just got to work out how.
The other crazy thing is, and my most recent episode is phenomenal. It just came out this morning. It's incredible. He's an ex-doctor who's now switched and he's been studying how to learn effectively.
Yes.
And he's got the most developed process in the world for effectively learning. So not just using flashcards, but how we learn. And like one of his big things is like at school, we're never even taught how to study.
Yeah.
It's like they never teach you. They just say, go do your homework. But how do you do homework effectively? How do you study effectively?
Yes. So one example in my latest book was this girl who said to me, so she got to university. She's 17. She's got her assignment and she's trying to find the tutor's office. She gets to it. She hands him the assignment. He looks at it. He looks through it. She's looking at him expectantly and he goes, is this a draft? And she goes, yeah. And he goes, oh, sweetie, I think I'll wait for the final copy. And she kind of said it against herself. But at school, you get to hand in three or four drafts. You're told of a night, now go over this, or here's a practice exam. Even their days in high school are divided into 40-minute chunks of maths, then physics, then chemistry, then history. And so there is none of that thinking for themselves. I think you said to me in an interview for the book, you know, after school, you never have to put your hand up again to go to the toilet.
Yes.
And so you have to unlearn all those things.
Yeah, yeah. There's something I've been talking about a lot recently is a big realization I've had is after you finish high school, we spend the next kind of 5 years, even maybe the rest of your life, unlearning a lot of the habits that we developed in high school. Like, you know, in high school, if you look at someone, it's called cheating. In the real world, that's called collaboration and brainstorming and coming up with solutions together. And I mean, communication is a huge one for me. I think communication is the number one skill employers are looking for in employees.
And teamwork, I reckon.
Communication, teamwork, leadership, just like, and it doesn't have to be public speaking ability.
No.
It's just how well.
Take people with you.
Yeah, because like if you go for a job interview and you could be a 2 out of 10 communication wise, but a 10 out of 10 technically.
Yes.
Do you think you're going to be perceived as a 10 out of 10 or a 2 out of 10?
Yeah.
A 2 because you can only communicate as well as you articulate your ideas, vice versa. You could be an incredible communicator, but 2 out of 10 technically, but you'll probably get the job because you communicate yourself effectively.
And I think why I put teamwork there is at school often you compete against the person next to you. Once you're in a workforce, you've got to act as a team member. If you don't, you're going to be ostracized. You're never actually going to make it into leadership if that's your goal.
And you've got to, I mean, there's still the level of, you know, competition in work, but it's far more. If you win, everyone else wins usually. Whereas in school, it's just like, you know, in order for someone to get a 99, someone has to get a 50. You know,
that's they say not under the new system. They say that, you know, it's no longer the bell curve, but you can't help feeling what you feel. And if you're sitting next to someone and they're getting, you know, like one teacher said to me, why do students come up to me and say, why did I get 88%? Where did I lose the 12%? Rather than seeing it from, I got 88%, which is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And I think we teach them by the way we assess from early on, we're teaching them that. But when you said, you know, you unlearn all those things when you leave, the problem then is you're not an independent learner, whether you go to university or vet or TAFE or you're going to the workforce and apprenticeship, you're waiting to be told to do something. And that was the way it was, I think, when I was at that age, but now you're wanting to be able to, or employers are wanting people to have ideas and think for themselves and ahead and do stuff.
I'm seeing on TikTok a lot. I don't know why, if I'm just seeing this or it's popular right now, but everyone's talking about how they're at internships.
Yeah.
And they have no idea what to do because no one's telling them what to do. Yeah. Or they're giving them, can you format this spreadsheet? And they've got 2 days to do it and they do it in an hour.
Yeah.
And they just sit around on TikTok because they don't know what to do and because they're not being told what to do. And I think one of the best skills you can have as a young person is being proactive. Yep. You're figuring out what to do. Yep. Okay, they've only told you to do this, but how can you take it to the next step? Can you go talk to someone? Can you figure out how to help out? What can you do to provide value to them?
So why do you think young people aren't just going ahead and doing it? Because they're savvy,
yeah.
They've got purpose. Why aren't they?
Because in school, we're just, you do what you're told and that's it.
Yeah, and so they've learned to do that. That's to be good. You don't have to.
You know, you can get 100% top marks just by doing what's told.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in Japanese class, I remember in year seven, I loved making movies. And we got given an assignment. And rather than do the assignment on a piece of paper and like a PowerPoint, I created a 3-minute video with my friend. And we used a green screen and we pitched everything. We got really good marks and it did really well. But people still got high marks than us. But I had so much fun doing it. And I learned so much about making videos. I learned how to green screen. I learned all these skills outside of what's...
The square.
Outside of just the information. And I was actually excited to learn the information because of the way I was packaging it.
Yeah.
If I was just doing a PowerPoint, I wouldn't really care about the Japanese festival we were talking about. But I got so excited because I had to present it and talk about it. And I guess to me, that's kind of like an example of like they don't encourage that. I mean, they encourage it, but they don't incentivize it.
Yes, and I think in that last 2 years, they don't encourage it either. In ATAR, there's just boxes they tick. So if you're a marker, have they done this? Have they shown this? Yeah. Have they done this? So even...
Well, it's computers now sometimes as well.
Yeah, correct. Even in an English assignment or a history assignment, spelling might matter. Or even creativity might matter because it may not be one of those things that count, you know, and the difference between analysis and interpretation and, you know, a depiction and little things that are little boxes rather than what is the big picture. And perhaps the word that's been stolen from the curriculum is curiosity.
Yes.
Because you did that with the video. You were curious and you learned all of this. Mm. But we never actually... Perhaps our children are graduating without being curious enough to take that first step.
Curious is such a big thing. I saw something and it was like a therapist said this during COVID. It's like you don't have to be excited about the future. You just have to be curious about what's coming.
Yes.
And I was like, that's a big one because it's hard to be excited about the future when it's so uncertain. And I mean, now COVID's kind of gone and it's still difficult because it's like, you know, I'm running live events and I'm getting excited. And every time we got excited, bang, it was shut down. I run my program, bang, shut down. Like just for 2 years, just constantly shut down. And I do think curiosity is a huge thing for young people.
Because you take some parents explain to me, why don't their kids want to go to these museums? You take them overseas and they want to go and get a selfie here and a selfie here and a selfie outside but not actually go in and explore. And that's probably the reason why. If you haven't been taught to be curious about something –
Well, as soon as you're curious in school, if you get too curious, you start wasting time on the stuff that doesn't matter. Like if you're doing an assignment and you're like, oh, what about this part of it? But that's not part of the assignment. There's no point in going down that. You just got to focus on what you're doing.
Yeah.
And again, like it's obviously how do you mark this? How do you – it's very difficult. I get it. It's a huge problem and it's not just an easy fix.
Well, it's not an easy fix, but I disagree. It can't be done. You know,
Finland's done it.
Our pilots practice – what they would do in a plane crash in a simulator.
Yeah.
You can't tell me in 2022 we can't work out a way of judging leadership and kindness and curiosity and teamwork and communication, for God's sake. There's a dozen different ways you can do that. One teacher wrote an email to me and said that they feared a child asking a question during class that took them down a different path because they had this much content to get through and for her class to do well, she just feared it, you know. And I have a really high impression of teachers. I know there's bad apples in journalism in everywhere, but they give their life to actually trying to build the minds of our kids. And I think one thing that when you're at school, certainly when I was there, that idea of asking questions was phenomenal.
That was me as a T. Every single report was, Byron participates, he asked so many questions in class, his marks don't reflect how much work he puts in. Every single report, like economics, we would read from textbooks and it was the most boring, dry thing ever and then ask questions. And in year 11, we'd just have questions and debates about all this stuff and I learned so much. And then in year 12, I think my teacher had some personal issues or whatever. All we did was just highlight from textbooks and I learned nothing and I flopped the whole subject.
Yeah.
I think, and I mean, it's not a coincidence, on a podcast I ask questions for a living, but going on the, you know, a lot of teachers have spoken, because I have a lot of teachers reach out to me as well. Even recently I had like a 34-year-old teacher and they say, Byron, I agree with everything you're saying, but I'm stuck in a system. I have to teach this, otherwise they get bad marks and I get I get fired as a teacher because I'm not doing well.
And their parents aren't happy and the kids aren't happy because they didn't get the ATAR they want.
They're stuck in it just as much as the kids are.
So that comes back again to that curriculum. To be happy at 25, almost, you've got to look at that curriculum. Mm. And I see there's changes in New South Wales that are now being considered where there are different paths to an ATAR. Mm. Do you know only about 50% of students in Australia get an ATAR? Mm. But no one's told that. Yeah. You know, parents are told, you know, go this, that. Some schools, particularly private schools, I think, are so focused on that league table of results and where they sit because it brings in sponsorship and the alumni, that the individual focus and status, that individual focus is kind of lost. And, you know, COVID, there was an example given to me in my hometown of Brisbane where the difference, the inequity in the education systems had this situation where there was upper primary, I forget it was year five or year six, and in one school, within a day, year fives and sixes were on their school-issued computer. They were having a happy hat day and kids were wearing hats, their teachers on, the 25 kids are on. In another school just up the road, a public school, two enterprising teachers went to Officeworks. They photocopied the entire curriculum for that term. Then they divided up the students, got in their car, used their own petrol, and went and put a copy of that curriculum in their mailbox because that's what that school could afford. Wow. And you think, you know, if that's happening at that age, as it gets higher, you can't help thinking that what is offered at some schools is not what's offered at others.
100%.
And education should be equal.
But the crazy thing is, it's like, you know, I know people from private schools and public school. I went to public school and they don't, like, they're not more intelligent. Like, they're not, like, better off. The only reason they might be better off is usually they have better connections because they went to private school and they've got, and I see they might have dads who are a bit wealthier who are in higher positions and can connect them and stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, it's, you could pay $50,000 a year or nothing. And the person who gets paid $50,000 a year, they might know a bit more, but they're not going to come out like...
Don't you think it's, the value of the teacher more than the family or the school most? You know, if that teacher is the person... My favourite teacher was my Maths 1 teacher.
And you remember her?
Him, yeah.
You remember him.
He remains a good friend of mine. And the reason being is because he found maths difficult himself at school, or not difficult, but he didn't whiz through. So when I had what was a silly question according to peers, he would know exactly where I'm coming from and be able to explain it. And I think that, you know, where do we teachers have such a difficult job. Do you teach to the bottom of the class, the middle of the class, the top of the class?
Yeah.
And in COVID, some schools have done some terrific things. Like there's one school in Queensland that gives the 11s and 12s Friday afternoon off and Monday morning off because they say that having a part-time job is really important. And so that means they can work, you know, on Friday afternoon, Saturday, Sunday, sleep in Monday and still get their work done. That's pretty good, isn't it?
That's amazing.
But a lot just went back to the old style of teaching or learning, and we haven't advanced from COVID.
I mean, there's the other issue. It's just like, you know, you go to someone who's needs to work a part-time job in order just to have the bare minimum and the necessities met, and you could have a private school kid or someone who gets all that met, which means they've got an extra 10 hours, 20 hours a week to study.
Yeah.
And then they come up, and then they get a higher score, which means, oh, you're much smarter. It's like, are they smarter or do they just have more time to dedicate to their studying? And I see this in university as well. People who live on campus, because they came from a country town or whatever, they've got to work, you know, 20, 30 hours a week, whereas people who don't, they've got way more time.
But they develop a more independence, more confidence.
Long term, I think it's much better. Yeah. Long term, they're going to be far more independent. They've got a better grasp of the real world, the budgeting. There's a lot more skills. But in the moments when you're working and everyone else has got all this time off,
it's very hard
to appreciate that.
And, you know, you said that country thing, which came up in El Plata, is that I asked some people who ran residential colleges at universities the difference between kids who walked through the door, and they said they could work out who would succeed and who wouldn't. There's that word succeed, but who would find it easy based on their confidence when they came through. And I said, well, what do you mean? And they said that those coming from the country had got their hands dirty.
Mm.
By and large, they had developed more independence, more confidence, because they had to do things, work things, maybe seen the cycle of life in drought and floods and, you know, animals dying and actually having to put your hand up for help. Mm. Whereas often in the city, and this is girls particular, my research, they didn't know what they didn't know. Yeah. And so they might walk to their car at midnight after studying in a library or after going out, not thinking for one moment, I shouldn't do this, or not knowing how to deal with the situation. Mm. I thought that was quite telling that, you know, that in our regional areas, often those things are taught as part of life.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I went on a trip recently and one of the girls who came with us, she's grown up very, very wealthy. And she even admitted, we were getting quite frustrated with her because she was like treating me and my mate like dads. It's like, we were all independent. We yeah. went with family, but she was like, what do I take? What do I wear? It's like yes. I don't know.
Yeah.
And she was just like, this trip has made me realize I have no independence.
Wow.
And I struggle to make decisions. And we're like, I'm glad you realize that because, yes, it's been,
yeah.
just been quite jarringly obvious to us and very frustrating because we're not here to baby you. We're all
– yes.
And she's older than me.
And she didn't have the chance though, had she? She wasn't given the chance by her parents to kind of do those things.
And her parents are amazing, but they're too amazing, I think.
Yeah.
Like they're so amazing. They're beautiful people. But
yes.
as a – you know, you got to let throw the bird off and let it fly sort of thing, right?
Yeah, you say that. It's as a mother of two teenagers.
It's difficult to do.
It's
sure.
harder, you know, because you don't want to see your kids hurt.
No,
you don't
want
to – you want to catch them before they fall.
Yes.
But yes, you're right. You know, fail has become a dirty word and it should actually be seen the first step in success.
Well, if you – like we use a story at Empower You. We say like what's a dream of a caterpillar? To become a butterfly, right? Mm. And so it goes up the stalk, it then – shoot some silk out of its bum and it creates a cocoon, and over time through metamorphosis or whatever it is, it turns into a butterfly. And then just like a chicken and the egg, it needs to develop the strength in its wings to break out of the cocoon. And it's only because it's developed the strength from the breaking out and
yes.
has the strength to fly.
Yeah.
If you were to cut open the cocoon when you see it wiggling and let it out, it'll just fall to the ground and die.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's only in the struggle where we learn to develop the strength.
Yes.
And you'd be doing it a disservice by cutting it open. And a lot of parents, I think, are cutting open the cocoon, helicoptering, not letting their kids
have to. Oh, I love that analogy.
You have to eat shit sometimes. In order, as you mentioned, the studies in the country show that they're more developed as people. They're a bit more resilient because they grew up in a tougher environment.
And, you know, the examples of that, like I know with one of my daughters, she was devastated in year 10 or year 9 because she'd handed in a science exam, and as she handed it in, she turned it over and realized something was worth 10 marks on the last page. And you say, oh, no, but, you know, she will never do that again.
Yes.
And it was heartbreaking at the time. And I was heartbroken for her having worked so hard, but it was a really good lesson. And I think maybe parents have to find things where their kids can fail. Mm. So, you know, and I don't mean fail big where it's lifelong.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't have to say that and feel bad, which I do. But you do, don't you? Because
so
it is so important for them to learn.
I grew up mountain biking a lot. My dad loves mountain biking. And he just takes us up to the top of the hill and it's like, you're going down or it's the only option.
Yes.
And you might stack it and you might hurt yourself. And we would, but it's like.
Do you remember the first time you did that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, I've stacked it heaps of times. And I never actually ended up, you get grazes and stuff.
Yes.
You wouldn't like hurt yourself
badly.
You're just, you know, you're wearing a helmet and everything.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess that really developed me as someone who. Because one of the biggest things when taking risks is shifting your perception of failure. If you see failure as a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like the comfort zone talk, and you'll probably like this, is if we say, imagine you're in your comfort zone and you step outside your comfort zone, how do you feel? You go up on stage, you start to play an instrument, we ask everyone in the crowd, they say anxiety, stress, overwhelm, blah, blah, blah. And I say, are they majority positive or negative? And they go, negative.
Yeah.
So if you have a negative association with stepping outside your comfort zone, why would you ever do it?
Yeah.
But let's sum up, most of that can be summed up in fear.
Yeah.
You have fear. But if you've got two options when you're in the fear zone, you can just step back into your comfort zone or step through it.
Yeah.
What do you think most people do in life?
Yeah, step back.
They step back. But if you were to push through it, let's say you played your instrument, you've now walked off stage, it all went well, how do you feel? Accomplished, strong, powerful, proud, blah, blah, blah. A majority of those words, positive or negative?
Yeah.
Positive. So now you're telling me you have a positive association with stepping outside your comfort zone. Do you think you're more likely to do it? And then we say most of those words can be summed up with growth. And the thing about comfort zones and failure is you're not trying to succeed when you're young at what you want to do. You just want to have growth because you might not fail. You might fail. You might succeed. Blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. So long as you grow
and improve,
that's what we should be aiming for as young people.
Yeah. And I think most young people do that, don't you think?
I think
that's their aim.
Human nature.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't. Some people live so comfortably in Australia, they just never ever step outside their comfort zone.
Yeah,
they won't even confront, because we don't have to confront. We can use texting.
Yes.
Like, it's very easy to stay in a comfort zone for young people. Everything can be done over the phone, and we can avoid conversations.
Like, well, I think most young people see that they want to improve. They don't want to win. They don't want to be the best. And I think that comes with that this wonderful sense of a lack of judgment. They don't judge their peers like at that age we might have judged our peers, or their parents judge their peers. But I do think they really value growth. Mm. Whether they're given the credit for it is another thing.
I hope so, because that's such an important thing as a young person. Yeah. But I do think, you know, school really teaches you success or failure.
Yeah.
You fail or you succeed.
Yes.
They don't go, oh, you know, I mean, obviously there's obviously growth in there, but the structure is built so you either pass or you don't.
Yeah.
You know, you get an 8 out of 10 enough or you didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
You can do it or you can't.
Yeah,
you do. Rather than thinking there's plenty of pathways to where you want to go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You get up and you do a speech and you get a 5 out of 15.
Yeah.
You're disappointed. Now you're not going to want to do a speech again.
And so I asked these girls in El Plata, these confident girls, where they got their confidence from, and everyone could remember a lesson, which goes to what you're saying. I remember one saying she went in this school idol and fell flat on her face. She was the worst by a country mile. People laughed at her, not with her. When she got off the stage, she thought, nothing is going to be worse than this. She actually said she remembers walking off feeling confident. Yep. And another girl said she took her grandparents' car to school and backed into a fence in front of everyone. Mm. And she was glad it was a fence and, you know, she had to pay for the car. But she said after that she thought she had so much more confidence as a driver. But in both of those, they failed in some way, didn't they, to actually grow.
Yeah.
But the word fail has just grown in its negative connotation. Well, and I wonder how you change that so it's seen as a positive thing.
I mean, they'd say the master has failed more times than the student has tried.
Yeah.
And have you read Brené Brown's work?
Yeah, every bit of it.
Yeah, like she's amazing. I've been reading a lot of her work. And at Empower You, we teach, it's a phenomenal section.
Yeah.
One of the most powerful. We talk about beliefs, and beliefs are formed by references in our past.
Yeah.
And so if you are scared of speaking on stage, is it because you went up on stage when you were 12 years old and it was a bad experience? Yeah. Therefore, you have a negative reference.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about that concept. And I remember there's a story in Brené Brown's book where she was like talking with a lot of men. And there's this one guy who loved doing drawings. He loved drawing when he was a young kid. And he drew this house and it was stuck up on the fridge. And I remember his uncle came in or something. And his uncle was like, oh, what's this? You're drawing or something. And he says, what are you raising, a faggot?
Yeah.
And he said that was the last drawing he ever did.
Yeah.
All from that
one comment.
That one reference that was so powerful, it crippled him from ever being creative and letting himself express.
Yes, and I wonder if, you know, young people take on the messages, particularly on social media around them. They live in such a wallpapered world of social media that they take on those messages, so it's easier for them not to think they're enough. Mm. And I don't know if I love that. I love how people are saying you're enough as you are. I'm not sure that actually gets through to young people in a sense, because you say that's one thing, what you've just explained, but the other thing I think sitting there is just that expectation, and it's okay to say, well, you're enough, but the expectation is you'll get into veterinary science or, you know, yeah, you're good at this, but the expectation is this is your path.
Well, the issue is our generation suffers from – I'm a big fan of ignorance is bliss. You know, I think it's like our generation now, whenever any of our peers do anything successful, we see it. And we're constantly comparing ourselves subconsciously or consciously. And it's very dangerous. Like there is a lot of good messages out there. But is the reason we're focusing on more passionate life as young people because we've seen how many people are living their best life through social media?
Oh, yes. But ignorance shouldn't be bliss, should it?
In some scenarios, I'm a big fan of, like, I don't need to, the example I use is like, like if you're dating a pretty girl or something and she goes down and she gets hit on by a bunch of guys or something,
yes. It's
like she didn't do anything wrong, she's just been hit on. I don't need her to come home and tell me about all these guys that were hitting on her and stuff. I'm fine with her going out. And someone shared this example or something and it was just like, I trust you, that's it. I don't need to know all the details of everything that happened. Did you have a good night? Cool, great. But through social media, we know everything that happens. Usually on the fly, they're texting you on the spot.
Yes. So this one school principal said to me, her daughter said to her, you don't know what it's like to have all your friends or other girls like your boyfriend's post? And she said, I struggled with that. I thought, well, that doesn't matter. To me, part of that comes back to being confident, knowing your girlfriend's gone out. Of course she's going to be hit on because she's absolutely gorgeous, but she's coming back to me.
Of course.
And I know it's easier said than done, but I'd rather build the confidence than preach the ignorance 100%. Is bliss.
I mean, the liking one's a better example because it's like this is happening at 12, 13. Yeah. When their brains haven't developed enough.
Yeah.
It's just jealousy and they're not sure. Like, sure, when you're in your mid-20s, you should be mature enough to understand that. But when you're 12 and 13 and people are liking and leaving comments and, like, girls do this comment game where you comment on one girl's post because you know when you post, she's going to comment on yours. I lived through this. Like, I had Instagram throughout high school. You know, I think girls definitely get the short end of the stick.
Oh, they sure, you know, Snapchat surgery where they're taking in, you know, a picture of their filtered thing to a GPO and want a GP and actually wanting plastic surgery to look like their filter. Yes. They know it's fake, but it's still there. Absolutely. I wonder if social media, which I love, and you ask the girls, on average, they spend 3 hours a day on it. These are 16, 17 and 18-year-olds. But you ask them to describe their relationship with it. Mm. And overridingly, it's obsessive or toxic. Yes. So they know that it's not good for them. But I wonder if it has made it harder to value that communication that you say, to kind of look in someone's eyes and to walk into a room and shake their hand.
100%.
And, you know, and I know in one case this – young girl's father died and a friend of hers said to her mum, what do I say to her? Because it's okay to say something on social media, I'm really sorry that your dad died and I'm here. That's easy because it doesn't require the same hard work as the hug, does it?
Yeah.
You know, and so we can't forget that part of it, that connection. And I guess COVID's made that worse.
I absolutely agree. I completely think that social media has ruined our ability to communicate. Which is why I push communication skills, because it's like if you're a young person and you can communicate effectively, you stand out like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
My mum is an occupational therapist and she has a business. Her biggest struggle in business is finding good quality OTs. Like she's got a great team of women, but like when they're employing, it's so hard. She gets people.
And why?
She's getting very frustrated because the marks to be an OT just went up purely because of supply and demand.
Yeah.
And she's going, I don't want 99 HR achievers. They have no communication skills.
Yeah.
I want 75, which is what it was at, because you attract people who
can talk and teach.
But at 99, you're gatekeeping so many incredible people that would be amazing OTs. Because part of being an OT is going into their house and supporting them and communicating with them and asking them questions. It's not just report writing.
Yeah.
And so she says that's a huge part of the role. And she, like, you wouldn't believe how many people have incredible experience, qualifications, but you sit in an interview with them and they're terrible communicators.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you just take even doctors. Mm. You want them to be able to diagnose something well. But if they're sitting across the table from someone saying, you know, your disease is terminal, how do you say that?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's – I interviewed in Fathers and Daughters this one doctor who said every single father who he says you have a terminal disease asks two questions. One is about – the time period he has left. Yeah. The other one is, why didn't I spend more time with my kids?
And that's the top regrets of the dying. There's a woman in Australia and she worked at an old people home and she was a nurse and she did a study called the top five regrets of the dying.
Yeah.
And one of them, for men specifically, was I wish I hadn't worked so hard.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd spent more time with my kids.
Yeah.
And the top regret of the dying was I wish I lived a life more true to myself rather than lived a life based on other people's opinions.
Yeah.
And so it's like it's a really fascinating study that links in exactly with what you said.
It's hard though, isn't it?
Oh, very hard. Yeah.
And especially when you're 16 or 17 or 18. And what I picked up in my research too is, you know, sometimes a young person has to take a trajectory if that's the only option. If mum and dad are paying, let's say whether it's university and they live in the country and they've come to a university college or come to the city to do an apprenticeship and they're helping with rent, then mum and dad still seem to have an inordinate say in how they live their lives and how young people can negotiate with their parents or find other pathways to funding is probably an important part of them being happy.
What you're saying is often if parents are paying, they almost have you – they have control over you because they could take away that payment. Because I saw a TikTok of a girl and she was just like, she didn't like her parents very much. And she was just like, sorry. She was saying that, like, when she was at home, they'd be like, well, under my house and under my roof, you follow my rules.
Huge.
And then she goes, I've moved out. And her parents say, how come you don't message us anymore? And it's like,
yeah.
What do you mean? I'm independent now. I don't need you. Like, I don't have to follow your rules. You guys, like, force all the stuff on me.
I find that so heartbreaking. I think it is such a mistake on parents' part because, you know, I think parents are doing that because, as we talked about before, they're trying to cotton wool and make things easier and pay in one sense. But our children are older, younger. They're reading stuff. They don't necessarily know what it means, but their life is very, very different from ours. So if they are paying and they would say, well, it's fair to have the rules for my house, but maybe – or my big thing is this if in your job you've had to disrupt how you do it, how we're doing this, where we're recording this would never have happened 10 years ago, right? And it doesn't matter whether you're Airbnb, Uber, whatever, you've changed the way you do things. But in parenting, we haven't. So we often hear parents say, I did this for my first and it worked, or I didn't allow my first to have a phone on social media until she was 15, so it'll work for the next one. And one school principal said to me she would know more teachers who had a book on parenting on their bedside table than parents. And that is right. And I think parenting changes constantly, and that idea of the rules on my roof is something that my parents would have used.
I
could see if I did that with my children. But it is quite confronting for parents, whether it's partners staying over and you've got younger children, to going out all night and you see, you know, that maybe they're drinking too much or they're putting themselves in dangerous situations. It's difficult because you're not a parent just to 18, are you? You're a parent forever.
And I mean, something you got to remember is it's parents are figuring it out just like the kids are.
Correct.
I think for me, I've just got, because I work with an Empower Youth program we run for young people, and I've seen a lot of parents, and like without failure, when I have the kids for 2 days and I get to meet the kids and the parents come in, and I'll meet not all the parents, but I get to meet the parents, they're basically mirror images of each other. Like, there's this one kid, and he was 14, which is very young, and he was such a go-getter, and he was hand up the whole time. I meet his parents, like, Byron, thank you so much for what you're doing. I think you're incredible. We want to get involved. How can we help? Incredible parents.
Yeah.
Incredible son. Not a coincidence. And then I've had parents that are, like, rude to me. They're just, like, they come up and rather than saying thank you, they'll be like, how come you don't teach this? And I'm just, like, and I look at their kid and I go, their kid didn't raise their hand. Their kid had no confidence. And I'm like, there's not a coincidence there. Like,
so you're saying the apple doesn't fall far from the tree?
100%.
So how do young people change that trajectory?
I don't know. It's tough because I've had such amazing parents. So yeah. I guess I was blessed to have parents that are incredible. You know, I love spending time with my parents. I love catching up with them. I saw them on the weekend.
Yeah.
So I guess that's probably one thing that I've really gotten learned. Quite lucky with.
Yeah.
And through references, and Brené Brown talked a lot about parenting. Like, I've learned a lot about parenting
just
by through kind of what I do with education. And
absolutely. Yeah.
So I've kind of studied it quite efficiently. And yeah, I guess I get frustrated at how little effort a lot of parents put in. It's like, this is a big thing. Having a child is a big thing. You should be studying. You should be learning. I look at Brent as well, who runs Empower You, and the amount of work he puts in with his kids and how much he loves them, and the study he does with his wife and how they put in work with their kids versus someone who just has kids and just kind of wings it.
Yeah, I think there's less parents winging it. More are probably being a helicopter version of it. Yeah. Like, you know, one school principal told me in this latest book how COVID happened and they had to cancel the school theatre production. So what they decided to do, how clever, is put it on with all the kids because it was in a school environment and live stream it so parents at home could watch it. Now, that is disruption at its best. But all these parents snuck into the back of the theatre, didn't tell the school principal, are standing there in the dark, and they said they had to do that or their child would be anxious, or they did it for their child. And I think it's more a problem of parents maybe mollycoddling their children than actually just letting them go.
I think it's a big one. I mean, it's the cutting open the cocoon, right?
Yeah.
It's like you've got to let them thrive. By
And particularly mums. And the Triple P Parenting Association based in Queensland told me that they think that might be because you used to have lots of kids, so families would go out and so you'd have a whole lot and they'd look after each other. Now parenting families are smaller. You have one or two and it goes up. So the role of mum and dad, grandparents is much more important. But as a result of that, mum and dad are more invested in their kids, particularly mum. You know, and one school principal in Adelaide told me that if he comes in on a Monday morning and there's a couple of mums in his waiting room, he knows it's a fairly normal week. If there's the dad, he may be half an hour away from calling the school lawyer because they come in at the last moment and want change. Now, that's not a good thing either, because too many dads probably describe the job as holding the barbecue tongs, you know, rather than being that more invested. But it's such – so I think it's more parents are – over-invested than under-invested, largely.
Yeah. I mean, and if they – I think there could be a lot of like – because it's a bit of generational trauma where it's like maybe if your parents weren't that invested into you, you're going, you know what, I'm going to invest into my kids, and they end up overdoing it. And they end up – because I do see a lot of helicoptering, and I guess I feel like my parents did such a good balance of not helicoptering but then still being there for you and being supportive but then also letting you be free and figure it out on your own.
You're very lucky.
And pay the, suffer the consequences.
Yeah.
You know, which – we're stuck in a time, but...
And even if your parents were terrific, there's things that we just know better now. Like an example of that in mine is, you know, a country mum who used to make a cake every afternoon for when we came home from afternoon tea. So how lovely is that? I had four brothers, but she would say, you'd have two pieces, and she'd say, do you want a third piece? And I'd go, oh, no. And she'd go, don't you like the cake? Now, she didn't mean that in a bad way, but she was making it for us. And that whole thing around eating now, of you don't make your children eat everything on their plate, you know, and so that they learn when they're full and when they want more. Yeah. And there's even a school of thinking now you put the meal out with the dessert so they can choose to have some of that rather than dessert every night after dinner. Now, as we go on, I think we get better. Research shows us better and better ways to parent. And that comes back to my idea that, you know, there's no parenting school. You don't need a course to be a parent. But you probably need to learn that things are not like when we were that age.
In the fundamentals, you know, like even this morning I was listening to Brené Brown's book and she's talking about how like when I say an action you did is bad, I'm not saying you are bad.
No,
I'm saying
action.
You're a good person who did a bad thing.
Yeah.
But kids often can't associate that. They go, oh my God. A story Brent always uses is like if I, you know, I think he made it up, but it's like if his son Caden came home and his son Caden had got in one of his best ties and drawn all art on his tie. And he comes up and he goes, look, Dad, look what I did. And the dad goes, oh, damn it, Caden, why'd you do that?
Yes.
And then he like ran off or something and he went up to his mum and he said, Mummy, Daddy hates me.
Yeah.
And it's like, because they don't associate that what they did was wrong.
Yeah.
And so just fundamentals like that, understanding that as a parent, I think is important and how you can like navigate that.
Yeah, my husband once said to me, he'd been married before, and he said, and this was a really clever thing. He doesn't say a lot of clever things, but he said, you know, you can give your kids two things, unconditional love and a good education. And then you kind of got to let them go. Yeah. And when you think about it, if you put everything into, you know, you love this child no matter what, you know, and they're going to fall and they're going to come back and they're going to learn in the process. And an education, and I don't mean a private school or a top range, but an education where they learn to be curious and to ask questions, then, you know, it's a pretty good start, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think parents can be doing a failure thing, you know, teaching their kids the importance of failure. And it's like, oh, you failed. That's all right. We try again. What do we do when we fail? We pick ourselves back up. Or like we learn from it. We grow from it. Because I don't see that happening at school very often.
No, and I think in homes, and when I wrote Fathers and Daughters, this was beautiful. You know, in separated families, lots of kids did not have a good relationship with their dad who had left until the age of about 15 or 16. And I know it's anecdotal evidence. You know, there wasn't thousands. But overwhelmingly, those girls who had a dad who said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it to end this way, you know, we both made mistakes. They said to me that dad had shown a chink in his armor, that he'd said sorry, that he'd shown a fragility they hadn't seen before. And that allowed them to say to him, I've stuffed up, because they knew he'd told them he'd stuffed up. And I think often dads say, you know, oh, you know, when I was your age, I'd go to the Sydney show and I'd get the train home by myself and it was 9 o'clock at night. And then their 14-year-old says, oh, Dad, can I go to the cinema in the city? He says, don't be stupid. You're 13. Mm. And so, you know, I think dads particularly need to. Mums, I think, often say sorry or show emotion often, whereas often from my research, and I know that's so gender specific and there's lots of variances to it, of course, but often dad was the guy who didn't say sorry or didn't show that fragility or were overprotective or wanted to, you know, and I think the more they hear our kids hear sorry, the more they hear that I failed, the more in relationships, because schools don't talk about consent in the way they should, for example. So the more they can actually say, look, I made this mistake, you know, and I did this, the kids are going to learn, well, I shouldn't make that mistake.
Exactly, yeah. And vulnerability inside vulnerability.
Yeah, absolutely. Thing. And you've done so much wonderful work in consent, so much wonderful work, but it's still this absolute, you know, in our platers, these year 12s told me about their consent talk. It wasn't consent, it was sex education. Mm. And they put in the science lab this big foam thing in the shape of a penis on the lab bench and put some condoms around it and said, now, today we're going to learn to put a condom on that. And the girls told me they're looking around going, all right, who's got the most experience here? Who's going to do this really quickly? You know, they want to know about, you know, urinary tract infections and coercive control and those things that are tricky and is not the place of a teacher. Yeah. It's the place of experts to come in and,
that's
you know.
That's the issue. We're getting like PHP teachers just to like, oh, can you do sex ed while you're there?
It's how?
Like,
oh. Cool.
Hold on, that's a big ask.
Yes. Well, and
I didn't even learn that. Like, the only thing I remember learning in sex ed was like STIs.
Yeah, well, in some schools, I'm not even sure that's taught.
Like, that's, you know, all we learn. And it was like, it's like, which means I have pretty negative associations of sex. It's like, if it just can be all this bad stuff.
Yeah.
But, anyways, we got to wrap up. We just hit the hour mark because we've been going for a while. Before I do ask every guest this question, what advice would you give your 18 year old self? Or I guess your 18 year old daughter, what advice would you give?
I'd give an 18 year old listening that life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And if you look around and see your kids, your peers way in front of you or way behind, they will catch up. They will come back. You will have challenges that they have. They will have challenges that you have. But think, you're going to live until you're 80 or 90. So stop, breathe in the fresh air and develop a trajectory that's exciting and adventurous and fun and full of curiosity, because it's a long time.
I love it. Well, Madonna, thank you so much for coming on the show. This is such a good episode. I've learned a lot. I think it's been a really valuable conversation. For anyone who wants to get one of your books, follow you online, where's the best place to go?
Oh, anywhere. Just look up Madonna King and they're all there.
Yeah, I'll put all the links in the show notes below. But otherwise, Madonna, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.